And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
They call it buzz in the news industry when something captivates us and captures our attention. Earlier this year, there was a terrific amount of buzz about the bees and the lack of buzz in the bees. And we all expected that somehow this buzz would continue so that we could get to the bottom of what in the world was happening to cause the extraordinary disappearance of some of the most important little creatures on this planet, the honeybees that pollinate our fruit and our flowers, our vegetables, and crops of all kind. Today, we go in depth as we find out why the buzz on the bees has been so silent. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As I was getting ready to do today's show, which actually was on Wednesday, decided to take a little break about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Got my bird, put her on my knee, and we grabbed a little ice cream and sat down in front of the television and turned on CNN, and I saw this horrific picture of this bridge that was falling all over the place. And of course, when you come into something like that, you don't really know quite where it is or why it is. And it was, it kind of panned back and the image of the disaster became ever more apparent. And they were talking about the fact that this, then you kind of wonder, is this actually happening now or is this some sort of historic memory, you know, that we're watching here? But it was apparent that it was actually happening. And so I was curious, and I listened, and then they mentioned that this was in Minneapolis, and all of a sudden, everything changed, because I knew exactly where that bridge was, the 35W bridge in Minneapolis, crossing the Mississippi River, right over by the university. I went to the University of Minnesota. As a matter of fact, I started there about the year that the bridge was completed, the 35W bridge. And I live just a few blocks away from where this happened. What can one say except that it was and is a most horrific tragedy? So it kind of slowed things down for me for quite a bit because I couldn't pull away from the television. It was very personal in many respects, brought back a lot of memories. I know the people that are in Minnesota. I know how they'll respond to this. They're brave, they're strong, and they're also very passionate people. And tragedies like this are felt very, very deeply, as it is with any people. But I'm a Minnesotan, so it has a particular significance to me. So I wish to extend my sympathies to all of my friends in Minnesota who are going through this right now. There's really not much that can be said that's good about it, and time will pass, and so too the pain. I'm so sorry to see this. So we have to get on with things, and so too today. We carry on with the Wild Side News, and in just a moment we're going to start the show with a Weekly Earth Summit. We have some great commentary on this week's Weekly Earth Summit. Then in segment two, we're going to go in depth to relook at what has happened to the story about the disappearing honeybees. It's an amazing story, one that was really quite shocking, that the honeybees, so responsible for pollinating our food crops and keeping us all in fresh vegetables and fruits and grains and many other things, actually keeping our entire system alive here, because every plant needs to be pollinated, and it's the majority, the bulk, the hard work is done by the bees, but they were disappearing in great, great numbers. So I thought perhaps we'd start hearing more about that, and I certainly was curious as a, particularly because I'm a scientist, I'm going like, what in the world happened? Well, in segment two, we're going to go in depth with someone who's been involved in the bee industry for 40 years to bring you up to date, and I think you're going to find it interesting. Whereas in the media, I just really haven't heard much at all about this story. There is a story, and you're going to hear that in segment two. It's one that we all need to be truly aware of because it's in our society. The problem is perhaps very definable. We need more science. We need more funding. We need more honesty to get to the bottom of this situation with the honeybees. But first, the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sidney Wildsmith. We bring you the thoughts of some of the world's leading experts in the fields of animal behavior, sustainability, activism. I'd like to start out this Weekly Earth Summit with a commentary by the legendary Dave Foreman, who brings us up to date on a controversy that's swirling around in the desert Southwest with a wonderful twist. Dave?
Down here in New Mexico and Arizona, we're having a full-on mass hysteria event in rural areas of southwestern New Mexico, southeastern Arizona, where the Mexican wolf was reintroduced in the Gila Wilderness area and Gila National Forest and Apache National Forest around it. There's been quite a bit lately about people claiming their children are suffering from post-traumatic syndrome and other things because of fear of wolves. Well, of course, the fear of wolves has been whipped up by their parents down there. A number of ranching mothers have been quoted in the paper about this terror. And so, interestingly, some other Gila mothers decided to comment on this. And what I have is a little statement from 11 women who are mothers who live in rural areas around the Gila National Forest and the Mexican Wolf Reintroduction Area. And I will quote from them. Michael White of the Farm Bureau purports to stand up for local residents whose so-called solid opposition to Mexican gray wolf reintroduction in the, quote, cities, towns, and rural areas, end quote, of the Gila has been ignored by the government. He claims that, quote, the day will come when a child or another person is maimed or killed by government-sponsored wolves, end quote. Our diminutive Mexican wolves may be scary from Mr. White's perch in Las Cruces, but here on the ground things look differently. We are mothers living in rural areas of southwestern New Mexico, away from town limits, at the edge of the Gila National Forest. We hike, sometimes alone with our kids. We already watch out for our children in the face of mountain lions, black bears, javelinas, and rattlesnakes, not to mention more prosaic dangers. We live in the Gila because we cherish its wildness, including glimpses of wild animals. Mr. White's scare tactics are not new claims for the Farm Bureau, an insurance company owning behemoth that decades ago strongly supported the original extermination of wolves from the western United States. Back on May 16, 2000, the Farm Bureau put out a press release claiming that rural resident Rene Dupree, quote, was attacked by Mexican gray wolves, end quote, and was, quote, rescued by two local U.S. Forest Service employees in the face of this life-threatening attack, end quote, adding, quote, no human is a match for a starving pack of wolves in a feeding frenzy, end quote. But Ms. Dupree was quoted in the May 17, 2000 Silver City Sun News saying, quote, my dog saw the wolves and one of them ran after them. The wolves saw the dog coming and one of them came toward me, apparently because he was curious about the other dog I was holding. I really didn't feel threatened myself, but I was a little concerned about the dogs, end quote. The Farm Bureau's wolf attack was fiction, And now the organization is ringing the same bell again, hoping to gin up more fear. Mexican wolves deserve to live in the Gila, their only home. This is also our home and serves as a vital part of the classroom that our children learn in. We strive to foster respect and care for all life. We deeply appreciate the gift of wildness we share with our families. Yes, there are inevitable inconveniences of living near wild animals, and no wildlife should be taken for granted or assumed to be predictable and safe. But the real dangers to children lie elsewhere. In recent months, a child in southwestern New Mexico died due to an unsecured handgun. A teenager on a ranch suffered a grievous eye injury from a kick by her horse. Earlier this week, a 12-year-old boy died in a stock tank. Why does the Farm Bureau scapegoat wolves in the face of real dangers? This is Dave Foreman. I think that's a very good question to ask. I want to thank these brave mothers for standing up and talking a little sense in this crazy world down there.
Thanks, Dave, and your friends down there in southwestern New Mexico, for your thoughts about wolves in America. It makes me remember of a time when I was in Yellowstone National Park as the artist in residence, and I had people creating art of all forms, including their comments and writing and poetry and other things. And there was a short piece that appeared on the wall, as I had everybody put their pieces on the wall, which feels so appropriate to follow what Dave Foreman just had to say. This was the second year in which wolves had been reintroduced into Yellowstone National Park, which had been a very controversial issue for people surrounding the parks. There were all sorts of fears, just like Dave brought forward in his commentary today. This was written by, she signed it, an enlightened adult from Idaho Falls, Idaho. I heard a wolf. I had mixed emotions. My father is a rancher. My name is on petitions to keep the wolves in Canada. But I heard a cry in the calm evening dusk. Tears came to my eyes and a chill up my spine. I felt fear. I felt joy. This is right. This is a good thing. The wolves are home. Hopefully that'll make its way back to New Mexico. Dr. Mark Beckhoff continues discussing some of the things that he learned during his trip to Tasmania to visit with other animal behaviorists. He shares his perspective on some changing views of animals through time as expressed by the members of his scientific community. Dr. Beckhoff?
Just looking at animals in history, how animals have been viewed and used, Neat talked about how animals were once held accountable for their acts. So, you know, there was a famous trial of a pig in France who had apparently killed a young boy. Animals in literature, the way that they're represented, and the changes over time from seeing animals represented as kind of automatons, you know, these Cartesian robots with no feelings, to being viewed as sentient beings. Metaphors using animals, animals, there was a phenomenal paper at this meeting in Tasmania that looked at how dogs were viewed in Japan during World War II and how they were symbols of compassion, attachment, hope, and things like that. You know, so it was just sort of seeing how the Japanese looked at dogs as a function of what was happening, you know, in their country. You know, gender issues, some talks on speciesism and feminism, and speciesism, you know, being the view that all and only members of a certain species, say, are emotional or, are smart or can do certain tasks. And then looking at how using speciesism is sort of parallel to feminism and the marginalization, if you will, of animals and women, stuff like that. So just phenomenally broad, broad topics. Oh, and wonderful stuff on looking at, New Zealand and Australia and especially Tasmania. They're faced with an invasion of non-native species and how you resolve balancing the interests and the rights of non-natives versus natives and trying to be compassionate, which, of course, is about the tallest order you can ever have.
Thank you, Dr. Beckhoff. We'll be hearing a lot more from Mark in the months ahead. And finally, Dr. Charles Kennel always has an amazing perspective on the future of this planet, and he is a man who is making things happen. He's a decision maker. He's a change agent. And he's involved in setting up a global sustainability network to monitor many of the dynamics on this planet. So when he talks not about things that may be, but things that are to be. Dr. Kennel.
I think at the research level, for us in the universities and those of us who do environmental and sustainability initiatives, is my new responsibility. I think the frontier is to get the scientists and the engineers working directly with the economists side by side on the same project. It's not just that the economists can take the results of the science after it's done and then estimate the cost and so forth. As you're beginning to develop new technologies for understanding the environment and then making altering the way we deal with it, at every step of the way now, you need to understand the economic impacts. You can't, in a system in which human beings are interacting with nature to give us the situation we have, you absolutely cannot. The economic dimension is essential in determining whether determining what we do as a society in many ways. You know, a new technology may be absolutely enchanting, very exciting, scientifically challenging, but if you can't make the business case or if you can't see where, can't make a convincing statement of need for this technology, it won't get built and we'll waste our time. And we scientists will waste our time chasing the wrong objective. And so we really do need the economists tightly on board as we make climate predictions, for example. The economists are going to say things like, well, okay, so there's going to be a shortage of rainfall. All right, well, tell me where. And so the climate scientists will say, well, tell me where you need it. And the economist is going to say where the most critically dependent, water-dependent activities are. And so the climate scientist says, well, okay, where's that? And they have to go back and forth and specialize their prediction down to the things, down so that the scientists predicting climate change can actually predict it in a way that's meaningful to the people who are affected. And you can estimate the economic impact, where the water shortage will be in your neighborhood, what the options are for storing water, transporting it from elsewhere. If you get your water from some other state, what is climate change going to do to the sources of water outside of California? And you need to know all of those things. You need the economists to help you estimate the economic impacts of large-scale changes so that the financial community will be more aware in the way it invests. So for a whole variety of reasons, the frontier, I think, of research right now is climate-aware economic forecasts and economic-aware climate forecasts. And then finally, just completely integrated. So it'll be one thing.
Thank you, Dr. Kennel. I like to think of this as the frontiers of sustainability. Sustainability is absolutely critical for our future. We all know that. Thanks to the work of so many people, like all of my listeners and so many of their friends and allies, we have to keep up our work to unite our efforts. One of the issues that's challenging our capacity to be truly sustainable is the issue of the honeybees, which this last spring made it to the front pages because they were suddenly disappearing. Since then, we haven't heard much about the honeybees, and so in just a moment, we're going to bring you the information you need to know to find out what's happening to the honeybees in America. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.